If you would all please bow with me, we'll open this up with a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for bringing us together to study your word, to praise you. Thank you for the musicians that were up here that led us in worship, that we could offer these sacrifices of praise to you, Father. We pray you that you found them acceptable. My personal prayer, Father, is that you'll guide me and that you'll guide my words, but I also pray that you'll give us a desire to understand the path you have for us, Father, and give us a desire to cut out all of the distractions that distract us from you. Again, we come to you with grateful hearts, and we ask these things in Yahshua's name. Hallelujah. Am I all set? All right, the battle for your attention. So, I found out that apparently most of you have an attention span shorter than a goldfish. That is, according to a survey conducted by Microsoft in 2015, in which they surveyed 2,000 Canadians, and then they studied the brain activity of over 100 more to see if their attention span was affected by phone or social media usage. When they published their research, they included this graphic, which claims that on average, the human attention span decreased from 12 seconds back in the year 2000 down to 8 seconds back in 2013. And then they listed the goldfish here that apparently has an attention span of 9 seconds. Now on this slide, this is right from the Microsoft study, but I put the little goldfish in the picture of the human brain on there. But if this is true, that means that for most of you, your mind has already started to wander to something else. But what does it even mean to have an 8-second attention span? I mean, if you're sitting here with distractions removed, your phones tucked away, unless they're being used to look up scriptures, you can definitely provide your attention for more than 8 seconds, right? And how do we know the attention spans of a goldfish? So the goal of their research, the Microsoft research, was more to understand the impact that technology was having on our attention spans. And this was a time when phone usage was on the rise. I guess technically it still is. Social media was on the rise. By this time, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter had been established. They had millions of users. And here's how they summarized the results. Here's how they summarize the results. The slides are mixed around. That's okay. They said digital lifestyles affect the ability to remain focused for extended periods of time. And then they go into a little bit more detail. It might be kind of small for you to read, so I'll read it. Canadians with more digital lifestyles, like those who consume more media, those who are multi-screeners, they're switching back and forth between different screens, social media enthusiasts, or even early adopters of technology, struggle to focus in environments where prolonged attention is needed. And they say, why? Well, it's the thrill of the new. Now, when this Microsoft study was first published, there were tons of newspapers and magazines that picked it up, like this one from Time Magazine. And they published an article with the title, "You Now Have a Shorter Attention Span Than a Goldfish." So today, if you go to the Microsoft website, you can't even find this study anymore. And what I find amusing is that everyone was so focused on this goldfish statistic, and I cannot even tell that this goldfish statistic was even part of the study. It was just something that they opened up the study with at the beginning. It was like a factoid credited to Statistic Brain, right? But even today, marketers will latch onto this and show how important it is to be good at grabbing the attention of your viewers. Listen, you have something to sell? We understand, and you should hire us to create your next ad. Ads have to be effective. They have to make you stop and look because you only have 8 seconds to capture your clients. By the way, this Microsoft study mentioned their gaming system at the time. It was Xbox 360. So, again, this was back in, 2015? And how great it was at grabbing users' attention, because the ads, when you signed into your gaming system, the only thing that was animated there on your dashboard were these ads. So, of course, they'd have to pay attention to those. They'd grab those attentions. And then, of course, I also thought it was amusing at the end of this study, If you had any questions, you could go to Microsoft's advertising website. So you begin to get this idea, well, maybe they had an incentive to publish this, and they were trying to push, you know, Microsoft advertising, or pointing out how important it is to be good at advertising. And it really is a shame that the goldfish took the spotlight, because there were some interesting results published in the survey showing a link between phone and social media usage and decreased attention span and memory. And this was published 8 years ago, which raises a few questions. So if it was true back then, has it gotten worse in the last 8 years? And again, what does an 8-second attention span even mean? And why are there so many studies on how well goldfish can remember things? I saw a quote from an expert in fish cognition, and I'm not kidding, that's what they said. This was an expert in fish cognition, and he said, in reality, goldfish have such impressive memories, they're often used as a common model for studying the memory and learning in fishes. And as a result, there are thousands of studies on goldfish that show that fish have excellent memories. Now, our attention span, what is our attention span? It's our ability to focus or concentrate on one thing for a period of time. There are things that we find interesting that can hold our focus for a long time. There are things we find less interesting that we have a hard time focusing on, even if we really want to. Perhaps the 8-second attention span is a reference to how easily distracted we are when we aren't even trying. You know, maybe it's when you're just having an informal conversation with someone or you're scrolling through your social media feed. But I think it's important to recognize the different types of attention, and here's one way of breaking it out. Now, if you go online and you look at other psychology articles, you know, they'll break it down even further. But these should resonate with us. So what I've done is I've kind of defined them and given an example here. So there's four of them. The first one is sustained attention. And I see this as a type of undivided attention, but this is where you don't have distractions. You don't have the possibility of distractions. So that's staying focused on something for a long time without getting bored or distracted. An example of that would be reading a book, putting your phone away and just focusing on your book. The second one's kind of like that. It's selective attention, where you're tuning into one thing while tuning everything else out. So, you know, you actually have to make an effort to do this. But this is, you know, an example of this is listening to music while studying and being able to concentrate on what you're studying on despite all these other noises in the background. So this is another form, in my mind, of undivided attention. But this is the one where you do have distractions in the background that you have to kind of get rid of. The third one is alternating attention, being able to switch back and forth between different things without getting confused. An example of this is watching TV while chatting with a friend, or while switching your attention back and forth and not losing track of one thing or the other. So you can have a conversation, you can watch your TV show, and you still understand what's going on in both realms. Some people might call this multitasking, this alternating attention, multitasking. And then the fourth one is divided attention, and it's doing more than one thing at the same time without messing up. So driving a car while having a conversation is an example of that. You're able to both drive your car, have a conversation, maybe even listen to music, and you're able to divide your attention up. And when I think of multitasking, I think most people think that when they multitask, they're able to divide their attention up. It falls into this fourth category, when really it's more about alternating attention and switching back and forth. And I've read that humans really aren't that good at multitasking. I mean, we think we are, but we're really not that good at it, because it takes time and effort to switch our focus from one thing to the next. And you have to recalibrate every time you switch. So with these in mind, I'd like to talk about the battle for your attention. And I want to discuss a few things that affect your focus and then give you a few warnings about the attention grabbers in your life, try to relate them to a biblical principle, and show how we have to actively take action to keep these distractions from impacting our spiritual life. I'm going to start in Proverbs 4, verses 24 through 27. So Proverbs 4 reads, "Put away deception from your mouth. Keep your lips from perverse speech. Let your eyes gaze forward. Fix your gaze straight ahead. Make a level path for your feet, and all your ways will be sure. Do not swerve to the right or to the left. Turn your feet away from evil. Verse 26 says, make a level path for your feet. This Hebrew word means to make something level, or it could also mean to weigh something. So that leaves some commentators thinking that maybe what Solomon was talking about is this idea of weighing something in your mind. You might see some translations say, ponder the path for your feet and make all your ways sure. There's a similar passage in Hebrews 12:13 that says, make straight paths for your feet. And some people think this was possibly pulling from the Greek version of Proverbs 4. Make straight paths for your feet. Regardless of the translation, Solomon makes this sound like something that we can take action on. Solomon may have understood. I'm sure he understood how easy it was for us to get distracted. And maybe it's because, you know, he uses this idea of not swerving to the right or to the left, and maybe it's because this idea of not swerving to the right or to the left has been ingrained in Israel since they were a nation. So I'm going to go back now to the Torah. We're going to look at Deuteronomy 5, 32 and 33. Therefore, you be careful to do as Yahweh your Elohim has commanded you. You should not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. You shall walk in all the ways which Yahweh your Elohim has commanded you, that you may live, and it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you shall possess. This is something, this idea of turning aside to the right hand, to the left, is something that's repeated in the Torah. And the idea, in my mind, again, is that you, this is what you are supposed to do, not turn to the right or to the left, not get distracted. So what I'm going to show you a couple other examples and show you how this was a theme. Deuteronomy 17:11. According to the sentence of the law in which they instruct you, according to the judgment which they tell you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left from the sentence which they pronounce upon you. Now, this is in the context of going to a judge or going to a priest to make a decision on something. And when they give you a judgment, they're basically saying, you cannot avoid that judgment. You know, whatever judgment they give you, you can't turn away from it. Deuteronomy 28:14 kind of repeats what Deuteronomy 5 says. You shall not turn aside from any of the words which I command you this day to the right or to the left to go after other Elohim to serve them. And then Joshua repeats this a couple times. And, you know, this is the time, Joshua 1:7, you know, this was at a point where Israel was finally going to go into the land of Canaan and take this land flowing with milk and honey. And Joshua says to them, only be strong and very courageous. This is Joshua 1:7, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. And then finally, I want to, I put a couple extra verses in here because I think this is a really good summary. This is kind of like in Joshua's final days, and he's giving advice to the nation. He says in Joshua 23:6-8, therefore be very courageous to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left. And then he expounds on what that means. And lest you go among the nations, these who remain among you, you shall not make mention of any name of their mighty ones, nor cause anyone to swear by them. You shall not serve them, nor bow down to them, but you shall hold fast to Yahweh your Elohim, as you have done to this day. And I think you're kind of, maybe like me, when you're seeing this phrase, not to turn to the right hand or to the left, you're kind of getting this idea of, we're not supposed to put our attention somewhere else. We're supposed to stay focused. And the first instance that I found in the Bible of where this phrase is used is back in Genesis, Genesis 24:49. I don't have it on the slide, but I'll just briefly summarize it. So Abraham had sent a servant out to find a bride for his son Isaac. And Isaac found someone, and he was talking to the family, and he said, now if you'll deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me. But if you won't, then tell me so that I can turn to the right hand or to the left. And so when he uses that phrase, you know, this is before the time of Joshua, before the time that the Torah was given to Israel. When he uses that phrase, he's obviously saying, you know, I'm going to look somewhere else. If you're not willing to, give your daughter over for my master to marry, then I will look somewhere else. I'll look to the right hand or to the left. I also noticed in 2 Samuel 14:19, this phrase is used in the context of avoiding something. So there was a wise woman who came to King David, and Joab, so David's commander, put this lady up to it because he realized that David needed to make amends with one of his sons, right, and mend that relationship. So this woman comes and says to him, you need to meet with Absalom, your son. And then David responds to her in verse 19. He says, was this Joab that put you up to this? And being the wise woman that she was, she answered this in a very diplomatic way. She's like, as you live, my master and king, no one can turn to the right hand or to the left from anything that my master the king has spoken. And then she said, yes, it was Joab. So you've got this idea ingrained into Israel that turning to the right hand or to the left is veering off, focusing on something else, avoiding even the avoidance. And this lady was telling King David that no one can even avoid anything that David has spoken. But in these verses, it's clear to me that Israel is being reminded over and over not to get distracted, but to focus on Yahweh and his law. Now, we find out later that Israel did not stay focused. They did turn to the right. They did turn to the left. In our weekly Bible studies here at YRM, we recently studied through the minor prophets and then also Isaiah. And I say recently, but really it was like a couple years ago. If you remember, Isaiah has 66 chapters, so that took over a year to get through. But there was a theme that I noticed as we're going through these prophets. The prophets were pointing out how Israel had failed to stay focused. They got comfortable. They started adopting the practices of the nations around them. And then the rulers and leaders in the land, they started to let justice slip. The wealthy stopped caring about the poor. The Torah was rejected. And they definitely did not follow the instruction that Joshua gave them here. I'd like to give you an example of this from Isaiah. So I'm going to go to Isaiah 1, the first chapter. I don't have all the verses up here, but I highlighted a couple really important points. Isaiah 1. And the context of this chapter is that the northern kingdom of Israel was fighting with all the nations around them. They were about to be taken over by the Assyrians. Isaiah was prophesying about the instability and moral decline of the southern kingdom, where he was, in the southern kingdom of Judah. And later we find out that was going to be taken by the Babylonians. So this is what led up to that. Isaiah says in chapter 1, verse 2, "Listen, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for Yahweh has spoken. I have raised children and brought them up, but they have rebelled against me." And then if you drop down to verse 4, "Alas, O sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a brood of evildoers, children of depravity. They have forsaken Yahweh, they have displeased the Holy One of Israel and turned their backs on him." Isaiah goes on later in the chapter to point out some very specific problems. And you know, when I was going through this, verse 23, is there anything here that you think could apply to us today? Isaiah 1:23. "Your rulers are rebels, friends of thieves. They all love bribes and chasing after rewards. They do not defend the fatherless, and the plea of the widow never comes before them." Late last year, November, December 2022, there was a Gallup poll of 1,000 adults across all 50 of the U.S. states, District of Columbia, and they were asked to rate the honesty and ethical standards for different professions. Of the professions at the top of the list, you might be able to guess some of them, but at the top of the list as being rated very high ethical and moral standards or very high honesty were nurses and school teachers. But at the bottom of the list were the telemarketers, the car salesmen, and, quote, the members of Congress. You know, those elected to improve our justice system. So looking around at our society, it feels a little bit like maybe Judah under Babylonian rule, or later the apostles and Yahshua living in the land of Israel under Roman rule. I mean, we're living in a culture right now that's a mix of different influences, just like the Israelites did back then. The Apostle Paul recognized this idea that as believers, we have to live in a society that's not focused on Yahweh, and we need to take action to avoid getting distracted. And he recognized that our fight is against spiritual forces of evil. And he says to stand firm. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 16:13, he says, "Be on your guard, stand firm in the faith, be courageous, be strong." And this sounds very similar to what Joshua told the nation of Israel. So today, I'd like to talk about the risks that we take in a digital age where information and entertainment is at our fingertips. We carry around these little portals that let us peer into the world around us from the safety of our homes. But how safe are we? And are they really decreasing our ability to focus? There are a few things that I would like to raise awareness about so that you can be on your guard. Have you ever thought about all the free services you use online? Have you ever thought about how they're able to stay free? Google search, Google Maps. Google Maps is a big one for me. Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, YouTube, TikTok. How about those free games that you download on your phone? Behind every one of those, there is a team of developers, sometimes hundreds of developers, along with servers, databases, daily maintenance costs. Now, when you open up video games that are free on your phone, they don't really hide it well. You know, they're either pushing a ton of ads at you or only giving you limited access to the game until you buy something or you buy a subscription plan. But one thing that these all have in common is that they're battling for your attention. And that's because they're designed. These applications are designed to pull you in and hold on to you as long as possible. In fact, a lot of these companies measure their success by how much you interact with them. And they give you incentives to pull other people in too. From that point of view, you're part of that ecosystem. And it's not just them putting an application out there for people to use. I mean, they need people to use it to keep it alive and healthy. By now, I think most of us understand that these companies are making money from the ads that they sell. You know, I've got a slide up of all these little social media icons. This must be a few years old because some of these icons, I think, have changed since then. But advertisers pay these companies to get their ad in front of you. Even better if they can get you to click on it. And most of us are okay with that because, you know, we can just scroll past the ads, right? But to make more income, these companies need you to interact with their product as often as and for as long as possible, and that's how they make their product valuable. So I'm going to say, for free, but actually I'm going to put that as a question mark there. Are they really all for free? I understand a little bit about what it takes to make a product valuable. For my day job, I work as what's called a group product manager. And that means that sometimes I have to go to our leadership team at my company and ask them to fund a new project. Sometimes I have to ask for money to hire new developers. Sometimes we can use the developers we already have to build something out. But you know what they want to know? They want to know how much is it going to cost and what are we going to get in return for it. Maybe I'll be able to save the company some money. Maybe instead of printing out all these papers, we've got this new website where people can log in. And we track it. We know how to track it. We know how to measure people that come in and interact with our website. By the way, I work in the insurance industry. Nothing as exciting as social media, but maybe I'll just help with improving the customer experience. Maybe I'll help them meet some company goal for the year. So when developers of your favorite applications or games were first started, I'm sure that they had to go and ask for money to grow, either to start their product or to grow their product. In return, they promised for some way to get users to stick around, and they have a lot of ways to do this. For example, they give users like you and me an incentive for sharing stuff that other people like. Sharing stuff that gets the thumbs up or the heart. On some platforms, you can even make money if you do this, and you get enough people interested. This eventually even led to what, like a YouTuber culture where people create content on YouTube full-time because they get paid for it. Some people have even left their day jobs to do this. It could also be as simple as like just giving users an endless stream of information or entertainment that caters to what they like. And along the way, these products capture information about how you interact with their website or their application. And then they show you ads that would interest someone like you. I remember Google growing into one of the richest companies in the world by being really good at selling ads. For example, there was a time when it wasn't so ad heavy, but I remember going into Google, you might search for something like, like instructions on how to blow a shofar, say. And then suddenly ads start popping up on the side that say, hey, you want a shofar? We've got a shofar. And now, you know, if you're a marketer that wants to go out and capture someone's attention, you can display ads to people who are more likely to buy your product. And I've been on both sides of this. I've gotten Google to place ads for me, and you pick, you know, what you're trying to target, what kind of people you're trying to target. I've also been on the other side where you embed ads into a website to make money from the Google ads. And Meta, the company that owns Facebook and Instagram, makes it pretty clear in their terms of service. So I bet you never thought we'd be going through the terms of service. This is, this is the company that owns Facebook, Messenger, Instagram. They own a couple other companies. But they're very clear about how their services are funded. Instead of paying to use Facebook and other products and services we offer, by using our products covered by these terms, you agree that we can show you personalized ads and other commercial and sponsored content that businesses and organizations pay us to promote on and off these products. And they're very clear. We use your personal data, such as information about your activity and interest, to show you personalized ads. So I think it's not a secret anymore. I think everyone realizes that your information is being gathered and being used to show you ad content. But I'm going into this amount of detail because I want you to understand the incentive that these companies have to keep your attention. I mean, it's how they fund their operations. And over time, these companies got really good at studying human behavior. They developed more effective ways to keep our eyes on the screen. I remember it seems like a few years ago, when I'd be on the internet searching for something, and I'd have to click a button that took me to the next page. I'd see page 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and it'd just be listed out, and I'd have to click to go to the next page. But somewhere along the line, someone developed a nonstop scrolling. So now if you're on a website or one of these social media pages, you could just keep scrolling all day, and it just pops new content up. There's no pages anymore. You could just keep going. And over time, maybe you start going on autopilot. Maybe there's a little scandalous content mixed into your normal stream of information. Oh, here's a video of people fighting on the street. Oh, here's a photo of a truck that drove into the lobby of a Taco Bell. Oh, this one's not safe for work, but I'll check it out real quick and then get back to work. But these companies analyze your behavior. They figure out that there are certain things that interest you and then show you more of the same. And it seems benign, right? They just want to give you what you want. Have you ever looked into the information that's stored about you? I know Google and Facebook have tried to be more transparent, and now you can go to your account and view all the data that's tied to you on your account. And it may surprise you to know how much you're being tracked. This slide, it's got a ton of bullet points on, and this is a fraction of Google's privacy policy. They start their privacy policy by saying, you know, we collect information to provide you better services. From figuring out basic stuff like which language you speak to more complex things like the ads you'll find most useful, the people who matter most to you online, or which YouTube videos you might like. So again, Google's very clear about this too. And what I did was I pulled some very specific examples because I found these kind of interesting, and I highlighted a few areas. First was the activity that they track, activity information, and this is all in their privacy policy. Terms you search for, videos you watch, views and interactions with content and ads, voice and audio information, purchase activity, people with whom you communicate and share content, activity on even third-party sites. And these third-party sites, I think these might be the ones that are using Google's ad services, you know, to make money. So, and it's prevalent. It's all over the internet. Your Chrome browsing history, anything that you've synced with your Google account, that's the type of activities that they track about you. But if you use their services to receive calls, maybe that's an Android phone. Or you use Gmail, which I do, to send messages. They're very clear, you know, they'll collect your phone number, the numbers you're calling, forwarded numbers, sender and recipient email addresses. So they can build this profile out. And recently I was looking at a thread online. It was like a message board, and some of the developers from these companies were talking about how this is like, what a lot of people don't understand is they can build this profile out and they can see very clearly who you're around and who you're communicating with. And a lot of people are like so suspicious now that they're tracking your voice through your phone. And these developers are like, no, that's not really where the story is, because we don't really do that. We're not gathering all this voice data. And yet, you know, you've got people out there who are like, but I know when I talked about like parrot cages, suddenly I'm starting to see ads for parrot cages. Then they start to get suspicious that, you know, all these, you know, that they're tracking your voice and everything. But they're saying what's more, what seems more sinister, they didn't use the word sinister, I'm using the word sinister, is that they are tracking who you're around. And if you're around someone a lot, they understand, okay, so this phone here that they're using for Google searches is around this other phone that's used for Google searches. And this person over here is searching for parrot cages. So maybe this guy wants to see some parrot cages too. That was an example. That's the gist that I got. It's like, you know, everyone's so focused on the voice tracking, which may be here. Maybe it'll be in the future. I don't know for sure. But where really, and it kind of goes to this location information. So the third column is what Google says that they track. You know, they track your GPS, basically your location, your IP address, which is like your PC or your device. It's an address that's connected to your device. Your activity on Google searches. Again, we already talked about that, your searches and the places that you label like home or work. But they also track information about things near to your device, like Wi-Fi access points, cell towers, Bluetooth-enabled devices. So Google probably knows that we just replaced our Wi-Fi system. I mean, based on this, Bluetooth-enabled devices, they probably know if you're, I don't know, I guess if you're connecting to a new wireless headset or something. I mean, it's all there in their privacy policy. But you know, you can go through and see all the details of this. It's published on their website. And a lot of people, they'll just click accept without realizing what they're signing up for. I didn't go through the TikTok privacy policy, but that's interesting in itself. It includes a clause at the bottom that your information could be transmitted to data centers outside the U.S. And it's already kind of like, well, what are they doing with it outside the U.S. when we know that TikTok is owned by a Chinese company? So now that you better understand the incentive that these apps have to hold your attention, let's look into how they control the content that you see. This slide is of a Facebook article from the Wall Street Journal. And in 2018, and actually some of these articles are, I noticed they're dated for 2021, but the sources that they got were from 2018. So the Wall Street Journal published several articles based on internal documents that were leaked from Facebook. These articles published by the Wall Street Journal accused Facebook of not doing enough to protect its user base. It includes a story, for example, of how Facebook knows that Instagram is toxic for many teen girls, but it also will not share that research, detailed research with the public. I mean, they're tracking all this stuff, right? But they won't share it with the public. This is the one that I thought was especially interesting. The title is, Facebook tried to make its platform a healthier place, but it got angrier instead. And for the details, Facebook made a heralded change in its algorithm in 2018 designed to improve its platform and arrest signs of declining user engagement. Mr. Zuckerberg declared his aim was to strengthen bonds. Let me just summarize this for you. I mean, it's a couple paragraphs, but I mean, if you go out there, you can easily find these articles. But it references a change to this algorithm that was supposed to improve interaction between friends and family. But internally, whatever this change was, it was having the opposite effect. People were getting angrier. And Facebook responded by saying, yeah, our algorithms can promote objectionable or harmful content. We're doing the best to mitigate the problem, right? That was their official response. But there are a few things I want to point out here. Social media sites like Facebook have an algorithm, and it can be adjusted to determine what gets displayed to you and what gets hidden from you. But they have an incentive to keep you engaged. Even, as the Wall Street Journal implies, if that means showing you objectionable or harmful content. These sites also collect information about you, which we just talked about, and build out a profile to make sure that they can reach you effectively. If you were engaged in any of this in 2020 or 2021, you likely recall the adjustments that were being made to the algorithm and the introduction of new features. It seemed like every day they were rolling out something new because there was so much controversy in 2020. And these changes aim to promote mainstream ideas on the COVID pandemic while flagging and removing alternative perspectives. And in practice, I mean, it makes sense to have guardrails in place, right? I mean, they have to, at the very least, prohibit illegal activity, so there have to be guardrails in place. And these algorithms are set up to prevent the need for a human to have to monitor billions and billions of posts and videos. So, you know, they set up these guardrails and they, you know, in these algorithms. Sometimes now they rely on artificial intelligence, and there have been some hiccups to artificial intelligence. It's, you know, it's just the technology is still developing, but you can find articles about some of the issues they've had with artificial intelligence. But again, these algorithms are managed by humans who don't share the same values or views as you do. But more importantly, they don't have an obligation to Yahweh or to biblical concepts. And with that in mind, I'd like to suggest three risks that I see to being a user on these systems. I'm not trying to condemn these platforms. I just want to raise awareness so you can be on guard, like the Apostle Paul said. Risks of using social media. First of all, it's that losing your ability to focus, the impaired focus. There have been many other studies, even more recent than that Microsoft study I quoted earlier, that show that excessive use of social media is linked to a decrease in focus. And when I'm aware of my own habits on social media, it's not hard to believe. I mean, these products are built for instant gratification. They adjust specifically to you, and they incentivize you to keep coming back. And this lost ability to focus, though, I mean, I should say, this is the important part. This lost ability to focus can affect you in other areas of your life. It's harder for you to focus then on the important stuff, like study, for example. Now, I haven't seen the documentary, The Social Dilemma. I've heard it's pretty good. But, and it may have been a good watch to help me prepare for this message. The Social Dilemma, I think it's on Netflix. The film interviews tech employees that explain how social media platforms, quote, nurture addiction to maximize profit, and they manipulate people's views, emotions, and behavior. And one of the film stars, who happened to be a former Google employee, now he runs a foundation that promotes more humane technology. Like, he's looking into the ethics of all of these apps and the technology that we have. And he's quoted in this documentary as saying, "We are training and conditioning a whole new generation of people that when they are uncomfortable or lonely or uncertain or afraid, we have a digital pacifier for ourselves that is kind of atrophying our own ability to deal with that." Risk number two, outside influence on what you consume. So what you ingest is being controlled. At best, it's being controlled to hold your attention. At worst, it's being controlled to shape what you think. And again, those tech employees that were interviewed for that documentary, maybe they have some insight into that, you know, that they're actually trying to influence the way you think. The algorithms responsible for moderating the content that you look at, you know, they're subject to frequent updates, potentially influencing your perspective over time. So what they're doing today may not be the same as what they're doing tomorrow. And the risk lies in that these companies are not super transparent about how the algorithms work, you know, or how they're assessing what's moral and what's ethical, or how closely they align with the Bible. Risk number three is kind of related to that. Possible changes to privacy in the future. Again, what they're doing now may not be the same. You got a preview of what's going ahead. Sorry, I jumped ahead a couple slides. Risk number three, possible changes to privacy in the future. So these companies are gathering information about you. Right now, they claim to be transparent about how they're using that information. They claim it's used for advertising. But at any point, that policy could change, and your data could be used in a different way than it's being used now. Right? I mean, we have to accept that, right? There could be things that change that would impact our freedom, you know, our freedom of speech, our freedom of worship. So what I'm recommending is that you're thoughtful about what you're posting, especially about emotionally driven topics. Right now, again, your speech is being protected, you know, and maybe you're the guy, you know, when your guy is in office, maybe it empowers you to be more vocal and you just get out there and you just starting online fights with people. But, you know, in a few years, it's going to change. You know, our political system tends to change every 4 years, every 8 years. But your published history won't. I mean, whatever you're posting there today is going to be gathered and stored, you know, backed up and saved in your digital folder. Today, we live in a nation ruled by unbelievers, similar to when the people of Judah were exiled to Babylon and ruled over by a foreign king. Or when in the time of Yahshua and the Apostle Paul, the land of Israel was governed by the Romans. Everywhere you look, and I got to say, especially this time of year, you see signs of paganism. And it's not hard to find sin if that's what you're looking for, right? It's enticing, like a marketing company that has made an ad to grab our attention and make us long after things we shouldn't. And the algorithms know what we want. And that's why it's important, like Solomon wrote in Proverbs 4, that first scripture I quoted, to keep our eyes straight forward, make a level path for our feet. I mean, he understood the challenges that his son and future king would face. And his son did face those challenges, and he kind of failed. Solomon faced the same challenges, how tempting it is to veer off. The leaders of ancient Israel, you know, they should have been role models to the nation. But now we can look back at their example and see the danger of letting our attention getting taken by the wrong things. So do I believe we have an attention span shorter than a goldfish? I really don't know. It seems unlikely. It is a funny anecdote, but I do think it points to a problem that we should address. How can I improve my focus so that I can give my attention to the important stuff? Look, there are many factors that affect your attention span. I'm wrapping this up. Getting proper sleep is one of them. Staying hydrated, eating a balanced diet, of course, making sure your brain's getting that nutrition. But today I put emphasis on social media because it's such a big part of our culture. And just be aware that it can affect your ability to focus. It can change your habits. But you can choose to practice a more sustained attention or a selective attention. You know, remember those four categories we discussed earlier? Where you make a conscious effort to focus on just one thing. You put away distractions for extended periods of time. You're on guard because while these distractions can impact your short-term focus, over time they can also erode your focus on Yahweh. I'd like to close with a passage from Isaiah. So this is from chapter 30. Remember, we quoted Isaiah 1 before. This is kind of in the middle of the book. And he set this up by first condemning the people for rebelling against Yahweh and relying on alliances with the nations around them for help. And that judgment is coming soon, right? But then Isaiah delivers a message of hope. He says, Yahweh will be gracious, and when you cry out, he will hear you. And in verse 21, Isaiah 30, 21, your ears will hear a word behind you. And this is Yahweh being gracious, being our teacher. This is the way, walk in it, whenever you turn to the right hand or whenever you turn to the left. So when you start to get distracted, you know, Isaiah's saying here, Yahweh's saying here, you know, he'll help us understand the way. I believe he does this today with his Holy Spirit. But we have to listen and we have to take action. Thank you for giving me your attention today. I resisted the urge to use gimmicks like flashing images every couple slides, but I think most of you in this room have trained yourself to sit through a 40 or 45 minute or not 50 minute message, right? Without a problem. But now we just need to stay sharp and stay in control of what has our attention. May Yahweh bless all of you.